This is the Book Waves Art Waves Hour. Interviews with writers on KPFA's nationally syndicated Book Waves program, along with interviews about film and theater and archive book interviews that stretch back four decades. I'm your host, Richard Walensky. This week, we're celebrating the 77th anniversary of KPFA, and I've been doing this program in various forms almost two-thirds of that time. Consider an extra donation to KPFA this year for all the ways in which listener-sponsored KPFA has kept you going, as it's kept me going, and thank you for that. Special gifts are also available if you go to kpfa.org and donate to help keep independent media alive. Speaking of independent, there's nothing more independent than live regional and community theater, and this program is dedicated to Berkeley's Shotgun Players with an interview with the theater company's founding artistic director, Patrick Dooley. The show concludes with a review of the play The Monsters, which runs at Berkeley Rep's Pete's Theater through May 3rd. As usual, you can find updated live theater and bookstore links and listings by clicking on the link at the top of today's Book Waves Art Waves page at kpfa.org. That link can also be found at the top of the Bay Area Theater page in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. My guest is Patrick Dooley, who is the artistic director of Shotgun Players. He is the founding director from 1992, when Shotgun Players was in the basement of Laval's Pizzeria in Berkeley, with occasional stops elsewhere, until 2004, when it moved to the Ashby stage near the Ashby BART station, and became solar-powered theater in 2007. Before we go into what's currently at Shotgun and the rest of the 2026 season, because what you do is you do it by years rather than September through September.
We don't do the school year. Yeah, we do the calendar year.
You got a BA in English. Where did you grow up, by the way?
I grew up in Virginia, a little town called Pungo, which is in the southeast tip of Virginia, just south of Virginia Beach, getting towards North Carolina. It's on the coast.
And how did you get involved in theater? Because it sounds as if something was going on with you.
Yeah, there was definitely no theater happening where I grew up. I mean, there was like a school play, which was my first experience. We did The Frog Prince in fourth grade. It gave me a format to channel my storytelling energies, you know. And I remember after that, my brother and I, we'd create little haunted houses in our bedroom, in our house, you know, and invite the neighbors or my mom. I made a puppet show with this character called Super Chicken, you know, made sock puppets, and just was looking for ways to kind of engage there. I remember my mom signed me up for a class through the community center in town. It was a town called Kempsville, which is about an hour drive away. And I was the youngest kid. There were all these adults, and then there's like this fifth grade kid who was in there. And I remember doing a scene from The Odd Couple with this guy that was, you know, could have been my grandfather's age, but I just loved it. And I just kept finding ways to get involved with theater in high school and college. You know, I didn't study theater. I took one theater class just so I could have my fine arts credit to graduate, but I was always in plays and was really interested in theater. And even all through college, was never really encouraged. Remember my father, like, you know, and my other family members were all like, you should get a law degree or do something with all that performative energy that you have that's going to make you a good living. I went to these auditions my senior year of college to do like summer stock and touring shows. And I got hired. I just went there on a whim. They were in Nashville, Tennessee. I drove from Harrisonburg, Virginia. I was going to James Madison, drove to Nashville, Tennessee, went to these auditions and these hotels, and I got an offer for a one-year contract to do Shakespeare in the public schools of Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah, I loved it. What I think I found out, and I did some other like regional theater work. I was in A Christmas Carol. I did The Fantastics, and I did a bunch of things like that. But what I think I found is that I loved theater, but I didn't want to just be an actor who was just taking whatever job they could get, you know, just so I could call myself an actor. I was really more interested in working on plays that I was passionate about and that I was exciting for me. I come to theater as an audience member first and foremost. And so I wanted to see plays that I had read and fallen in love with.
What was the first professional show you saw?
Well, the first professional show I saw, you know, I have to tell you, there were two shows I saw, and I can't remember which one I saw first. I was actually at the end of like my end of high school, just beginning college, and someone took me to go see, I guess it would have had to been college because it was late 80s. I saw Glengarry Glen Ross by David Mamet. I couldn't imagine conversations like that could happen on a stage in front of people, you know? I mean, you have Mamet saying this. I said, "What?" You know, this is Virginia boy growing up in the country. And then you hear all these like city folks like, talking like that. Like, oh, Lordy, you can put that on and people pay money for that? You can do that and get paid for it? And then I remember seeing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? My grandmother took me to go see Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I mean, it felt so, it was so raw. There was such a raw, the raw family battle that was going on there. It felt very familiar in an uncomfortable way. And it was startling to see a play where people were just like stripped down to the timbers, you know, to see that kind of like just raw, have that raw emotional experience in a theater. It wasn't the circus show that you saw or the pantomime thing or the mime show, whatever. It was a really incredibly visceral experience for me. After that, I was like, I just was seeking more of that. Like, how can I have that experience again?
At the same time, you were going to movies.
Well, yeah, and I was in high school. I'm going to see movies. I saw Children of the Corn, you know, we saw Rocky Horror Picture Show. I mean, I was going to the movies, but there weren't, you know, I lived in Virginia. You didn't have the Art House. You didn't have the Elmwood. You know, you didn't have the Rialto. You weren't seeing the National Theater live at the theaters in Virginia. You were seeing the latest car chase movie. You were seeing Porky's.
What I'm trying to drive at here is the difference for Patrick Dooley between going to a movie or watching something on television and seeing Virginia Woolf live in front of you with an audience.
Yeah, sitting on the front row also. I remember just being, I almost felt embarrassed for them that I was so close that I could see them and they could see me seeing them. Like, I shouldn't be witnessing this conversation. I should leave the room so y'all can finish your family fight without me, without us all watching you. The immediacy of that was very, it shook me. I think I've always been drawn to the immediacy of theater and that the phenomenon that we all talk about, but it's only happening right then. You can never see that again. And when you come back, you'll be with a different group of people and the performance will always be a little bit different. Your experience of it will be a little different, but like the theater is this ephemeral art form that's here and then it's gone.
When you were finally in college and you were actually on the other side of the stage and you were performing, what was that feeling like for you in those early days? Do you even remember?
Yeah, sure. And I remember doing, like, I was in Cloud Nine by Carol Churchill. I think even before, I think it had just been released and hadn't even made the regional theater circuit. And I was having the experience of like what it might be like to be those actors in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, trying to embody these stories and have the experience for the audience that I had, like returning that favor in some ways of going to those sort of like dark places in the human psyche and are those places that we all feel but don't necessarily talk about in polite company and having a story that you can sort of reenact them and have those sort of those conversations through the ideas and through the characters with an audience. I think there's something about that we were letting everybody know it's okay. We know that you're thinking the same thing we are. There was sort of like this tacit understanding that all of us have these experience these things and theater is the format that we use to discuss them. Because actually coming right out and talking about the fact that you might have these feelings, it's just not something you could do. At least something I could do with my friends and family. But if I could do it in the form of a play, we're putting it out there for all of us to go, yeah, I know what that is. where that landed me was coming out to visit my brother who was going to UC Berkeley. He was going to Cal studying art, studying ceramics with Richard Shaw there. And he had told me that there was this pizza parlor theater. They were doing a play called Portrait of a Young Artist as a Sexual Being.
So you come to Berkeley to visit your brother. You decide you're going to stay in Berkeley.
The very quick version of the story is, I was staying with him. The first place he took me was the old Berkeley Bowl on Shattuck Avenue, the old bowling alley Berkeley Bowl. I fell in love with all of the different foods here. He took me into the campus, you know, and suddenly, like, it was like the United Colors of Benetton. Like, every kind of person you could imagine was walking around on this campus. I grew up in rural Virginia. It was black folks and white folks. But here, it was like people from everywhere. And you go to the restaurants and you're getting like Eritrean food by people from Eritrea. I didn't even know there was an Eritrea until I came to California, you know? And so I just sort of fell in love with the multiculturalism, the architecture, the weather, the people. And I was like, let me just stay here a little longer. He introduces me. He tells me about this little theater space. I go down there just to like look at it. And the day I went down, they were rehearsing a production of The Tempest. There was a group called Subterranean Shakespeare that used to be down at Laval's. And the director said I could stick around and watch. I got a pint of beer, you know, smoking a cigarette. Back then, you could do that at Laval's. And watching this rehearsal, and the rehearsal, I was there. An actor quit the rehearsal, you know, at the end of the rehearsal. And I remember the director turning to me and saying, you said at the beginning when you that you had done some theater. Would you mind stepping in to play Ariel in our production of The Tempest? We open in 8 days. We'll give you free pizza every day. I was on my way to Seattle, and I was going to go there as my next stop. I said, well, maybe I'll stick around and do this. And on my way, after coming on my way back to Laval's to say yes, I said, what if I offer him a deal that I'll do this play if he'll let me do the stage reading of a play that I had read but always wanted to hear? It was a play by David Mamet called Edmund. Could I host a reading of this play in exchange for playing Ariel? And he said, sure. And he goes, do you have a theater company? And I was like, yes, I have a theater company. And I just sort of fabricated it all right there. Like, you know, the next day I came back to him and had to come up with the name of the theater company in between that meeting and the next meeting. I put an ad in the SF Weekly. It was a help wanted actors. I think I had 13 or 14 people, you know, leave a message on my little phone machine. You know, before like even cell phones or pagers, it was like an answering service. And we did that show. We did a reading of that show. And the actors after the reading said, can we do this again? Can we just do a show? And they actually let at Laval's, they let us do Wednesday nights while they were doing this other play. They let us do Wednesday nights our Edmund. And Robert Hurwitz, who was writing for the East Bay Express at the time, he was a critic for the Express before he moved to the Examiner and then the Chronicle. He came and did a little capsule review in the East Bay Express, gave it a great review, and we were off to the races.
Is that when you came up with the name Shotgun?
I came up with the name for the Shotgun Players day two. You know, the day when I was coming back to explain to him how I was going to do a stage reading of this play. And the expression, it actually comes from expression to break it down like a shotgun, which is, you know, I'm from rural Virginia and everything. Everybody sort of speaks in sort of like this unique vernacular of the South. Like every region has their own sort of like phrasing, ways they describe things. And to break it down like a shotgun basically means like to get to the heart of the matter, cut to the chase. Give me the goods. What do you need? You need $5? What is it? And I wanted to do theater that got to the heart of the matter. I wanted to do plays that broke it down. And I was thinking, I wanted to do plays that break it down. And I thought, breaking it down with the Shotgun Players. And I just thought, I would be curious who those people were. And one of the things I discovered when I came to the Bay Area is that when you say you're from the South, I was living in New York just before I came out here. When you're in New York and you say you're from the South, they think you're a dumb redneck. But when you come to Berkeley, California, and you say you're from the South, they're like, tell us about your people. Tell us about the collard greens and the grits. Tell us, and we want to know about your Southern culture, you know? And so I was sort of like it was like, okay, people might kind of enjoy this. You know, this might be an entryway for me.
I guess at that point you had to get a job.
I was waiting tables at a restaurant just opened in Oak and Jack London called Kincaid's. And it just was starting. So, you know, and now they've got a place called Skates, you know, also. But they were just opening. They were looking for people. I got a job waiting tables there. And then And the first week of rehearsal, I got a job working at this coffee shop next to Laval's. So I would do the lunch shift. I would open this coffee shop. It was Cafe Nefeli. It's not there anymore. It's a Greek cafe. Right now, they were at 1854 Euclid. Laval's was 1834 Euclid. And I would go open this coffee shop at 7 o'clock in the morning, work there until 11, when the owners, Nassos and Pascal, these two Greek guys, would come in. And then I would wait tables from 11 to 2, the lunch shift, take a shower, come to Laval's, rehearse the play, start, rinse, wash, repeat, you know, and be back at the coffee shop. And so the first customers of mine at the Shotgun Players were my customers at the coffee shop. I better go see this guy's play because I'm going to have to see him tomorrow morning and he's going to ask me why I haven't gotten a ticket yet, you know. And my first board of directors, my first audience members, subscribers, patrons were all people that I make cappuccinos for.
You're listening to an interview with Patrick Dooley, who is the artistic director of Shotgun Players. The Goat or Where is Sylvia by Edward Albee plays at the Ashby Stage through May 3rd. And for more information, you could go to shotgunplayers.org. I'm Rich Walensky on the Book Waves, Art Waves Hour. This was 1992. You continued that kind of life. And when did things begin to change to a point where you realized, hey, this is my life?
There were a couple quick milestones. One of them was, I've been doing it, it was 92 we got started. In 1997, I turned 30 years old. And I remember thinking like, okay, this is sort of a pivot point. I mean, you're turning 30. You're going to, like, what are you going to do? You're either going to do this or you're going to do something else. And I decided I was going to try to keep giving it a shot. But I felt like if I was going to do that, I was going to have to quit drinking. So I quit drinking when I was 30 years old because, you know, the party life was a real, was, you know, when you're a young theater maker, that's what you did. The thing I'd left out of, like, after rehearsal is then I would go to the bar and drink until 2 o'clock in the morning and then wake up at 6:30. You know, you can only do that for a certain period of time in your life. And I was sitting at the point like, I think this way of life has reached its end. So I quit drinking when I was 30. And then suddenly I had all this extra energy all day long. And that was a big turning point. The other thing I would say that happened was we did a collaboration in 2001 with Word for Word. It's a theater company in San Francisco that takes works of literature and they stage it. And we did a production of Winesburg, Ohio, Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, that opened at the Magic Theater in San Francisco and then moved to what was called at the time the Julie Morgan Center for the Arts. It's now the Berkeley Playhouse. And we sold it out. Everywhere we went, it sold out. And we were selling tickets and we were making money. People found out who we were. Suddenly all these people that were going to Word for Word, which are more like institutional theater goers, you know, their patrons are people that live in the hills. They were typically just going to Aurora. And they were like, I don't know about this pizza parlor theater company. I don't know about them. But when we did the show with Word for Word, they're like, huh, maybe they're serious folks. They started coming and that changed our demographics and started like introducing us to a wider pool of folks. And then I would say the other big pivot point for us was when we had the opportunity to, we left Laval's in like 97, 98, and then we were sort of itinerant and performed in 40 different venues across the Bay, Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley, until 2004 when we purchased this building. And we own this building. I mean, we're buying it. We will own it. You know, we hold the note. It was like the location, location, location. We had the BART station right across the street for parking, for transportation. We're right off Highway 13, Ashby Avenue, easy to get to from wherever. Bus lines, I'm coming and going. And you're right there on a busy street corner. Suddenly everybody knew who we were. They weren't trying to find us somewhere. And then things really started to pop.
I'm going to jump ahead. The final show of the 2026 season is The Death of Meyerhold by Mark Jackson, which had its world premiere at Shotgun in 2004 at both the Live Oak and Julia Morgan. Did that come before Ashby Stage?
It was not at the Ashby Stage. Yeah, it wasn't actually 2004. It was 2003. Penelope was born. My first daughter was born in 2004, in June of 2004. And we started the show in November, December 2003. That was another huge show for us. That was another big point, frankly.
You did that show, and then after that was the next show at Ashby?
No, we had another couple shows at the Julia Morgan. We were in residency there for a while, so we did that there. We did The Miser by Molière. We also did Murat Saad play called Quills by Douglas Wright. I believe Douglas Wright is the playwright there. Another play called Abingdon Square. And then the opportunity to buy the Ashby stage came in. We bought this building in 2004. We didn't start performing here. We got the building in the spring of 2004, but we didn't do our first show here until the end of that year. It was Travesties. Dog Act, which we moved over from a San Francisco venue. It opened in San Francisco, then moved here for 3 weeks. And then we opened Tom Stoppard's Travesties at the end of that calendar year of 2004.
That's when it all began to click in.
Yes, and we had our first full season there in 2005.
So Ashby Stage becomes the home of Shotgun Players. And I guess over the years, 2007, you put in the solar, turned it solar. I did notice that the shows became more elaborate as time went on.
What does that look like to you when you say more elaborate?
Well, it seemed like the sets became better. I remember seeing Stoppard there. The seats became better. I mean, a lot of things improved over time.
The pews that are in the theater were part of the original church that was built. There's been a church on the site for over 125 years, but those pews were installed in 1960 the building we're in now was built. And what we did was say, we got to put some cushions on these pews. You know, if we're going to ask people to sit here for 2.5 hours and watch a Stoppard play, we put installed back cushions and seat cushions. But we wanted to keep the open pews because we loved the way that sort of just like kind of brought everyone together. You weren't divided up. We were all sort of like the masses sitting together in the churches, in the church pews.
So 2019, you took a sabbatical.
3 months. It was 3 months. That was a long time.
Patrick Dooley, what happened in 2020, of course, was the pandemic, and a lot of theater companies folded shortly thereafter. And of course, I could give a list. Cal Shakes, 42nd Street Moon, Custom Made, Bay Area Musicals, and more recently, Aurora. I know that TheaterWorks and ACT kind of moved into life support mode, but it sounds as if somehow Shotgun did not have that problem.
Yeah, I mean, we're like the, you know, can't stop, won't stop theater company. You know, we're just, I joke, but like we're like a hybrid between a cockroach and a rat. Like we're going to be the last one standing. Like we can't be killed. I think a lot of that has to do with, we have a very loyal audience base, you know, and the folks that have been following us from like Laval's to all the different parks and parking lots, and they followed us around. We stayed in connection with our audience throughout the pandemic. We were creating content that we're pushing out. We started doing a little podcast, audio plays. We commissioned a bunch of plays, new works by artists all over the country and even stuff in the UK. We were just trying to find ways to keep the conversation going with our audience. You know, I think the one thing that we get is that, and this is going to sound kind of corny, but when we got our nonprofit status in 1997, something that really struck me was that your tax exempt designation is something called a 501c3. That's the thing that's sort of assigned to the nonprofits. And next to that, it says, which is designated as a community service organization. So I've been sort of meditating on what it meant to be of service to your community. I've often, when I think about what we're trying to be here, this theater, we're in a neighborhood. We're not in a downtown. We're not in a business district. We're surrounded on all sides by residences, apartment buildings, and homes. I see us as trying to reimagine what it means to be a community theater. How are we a place where we're hiring local artists? The 94703, which is where our theater is our biggest zip code. That we buy our baked goods from a local place. We got our solar panels from Sunlight and Power, which is just down the street. Like we're invested in the community. I like to say that we're like trying to be the farmer's market of theaters, you know, the buy local. And it's going to be kind of funny looking, but it's going to taste good. That's our approach. And I think that people in Berkeley appreciate that that personal touch when you go to the coffee shop and the owner is there making the coffee. I'm in the lobby in the theater, standing by the work that we make, you know? And if you don't like something, I am there for you to tell me. So you can have that direct connection between the creation of the work and the work itself. And that even though we've had smaller budgets in many of the theaters that you mentioned that have closed, we tell everybody that's working here that like, we know that we're not able to pay you what they can pay you at some of these bigger theaters, but we want all of us to feel invested, to feel a sense of ownership of the work that you're doing. So even though these older actors might not be paid as much money, they know that their voice and their artistic contributions are going to be appreciated and heard and seen and given air to take shape. So they have a sense of like, I'm an owner of that work. I'm not a hired gun that they may see again in 5 years. I'm a part of this organization, part of this community. We're a theater that even though we don't do plays in rep and we don't have a, you know, but we do, there's a lot of people that we've been working with for 20 years. We're into long-term relationships with our artists. So you'll see that. And I think that our audience feels that and appreciates that.
What I see is that each year you seem to come up with one show or two shows that just you can extend. I mean, it struck me after the pandemic that somehow, because it was a major Broadway show, you managed to snag Natasha and Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, which I saw on Broadway and which folded under horrible circumstances. And you managed to run that for 4 months.
4 months. And let me tell you, but this gets back to what I was saying earlier, Richard. We got to do that play because Dave Malloy, who wrote it, got his start working for us. And he was sleeping on couches and teaching kids, you know, how to take the SAT test and selling records at Rasputin. And I got some money to commission someone to write a show. We commissioned him to write a show called Beowulf, A Thousand Years of Baggage. That became sort of like a runaway hit for us. We raised another $50,000 and we took that show to New York because we felt like, you know what? This thing is special. We want to take this to a bigger stage. And we took that show there and the people from Ars Nova, I went over to talk to Jason Egan, the artistic director at Ars Nova, and said, would you like to take our show to Ars Nova? And he goes, we don't remount other people's shows, but I'll come see it. He came, saw it, and he said, who is Dave Malloy? And so I gave him Dave Malloy's email address, and he gave Dave Malloy $25,000 to write not Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. And so Dave, you know, so the idea is like if you're investing in your people, you try to find a way to give your people a platform to shine. And when they do, and they make something fantastic, and they because they love you, they say, when this show has its West Coast premiere, I want it to go to my original stomping grounds at the Shotgun Players. And so we got the rights to do the West Coast premiere because of that long relationship that we have with him as a human being and as an artist.
Would that show have run longer if you could have? I mean, was
Oh, yeah.
this?
And you mentioned that we have some shows that'll run longer. And the only reason we don't have other shows running longer is because we've got other shows coming in. We're on a streak now where every show we've done is extended and had sold out runs, but we have another show scheduled to load in. We always have a little bit extra space at the end of our season for our show, just in case it does. And that's what's happened. All of our shows, we'll just run them for another month or two until the other next show is ready to come in. I could have run Magnolia Ballet longer. You know, we could have run Art longer. We could have run Yellowface longer, but we just had to have other shows had to come in. There are some theaters in New York that will not really put their opening dates for a show. They'll just let it, if they're going to run it, they'll just keep running it. And then they'll do the show later on when it's. But we don't have that relationship with our artists. They contract with us a year in advance. And so they got to do what they got to do it.
I already noticed that from the initial article that Lily Janiak had written for the Chronicle, every show of the season has now been extended longer.
Yeah, that's right. We've extended everything going back a year and a half, almost 2 years. Every show is extended and could have gone longer. We're at 93% capacity for the last 2 years. And the only reason it's not 100 is because sometimes people just don't show up. They buy a ticket and then they don't come. I mean, we still get the money for it, but we're basically sold out. We sell at all of our shows. Part of that is having a loyal audience that starts to trust that you're going to make good work. But you know, we're also one. We have a word in our mission statement, which is we have the word affordable there, so we're a safe bet. A lot of folks will take a shot at us.
You're listening to an interview with Patrick Dooley, who is the artistic director of Shotgun Players. The Goat or Where is Sylvia plays at the Ashby Stage through May 3rd. And for more information, you could go to shotgunplayers.org. I'm Rich Walensky on the Book Waves, Art Waves Hour. Patrick Dooley, a couple of questions before we get to the season. The first is an interesting point about bringing in younger audiences. A few weeks ago, I interviewed John Fisher of Theater Rhino, and I mentioned younger audiences. And he said, I don't worry that much about that because older audiences come in because they can afford it, and I don't feel the need to push for that. What's your impression of that?
Yeah, I want to give John a call and say, come on, man. You know, I mean, I feel like it's not, yes, sure, older folks, you know, and I count myself almost as one of those. My youngest is still, I got one still in high school, the rest have all gone, you know, have got more disposable time and disposable income, so they can do that. But I got to tell you, you want to have an audience that spans all the generations because it changes the experience for everyone in the room. You know, when you're in a room, when there's 20-year-olds and there's 80-year-olds in the room, they're all experiencing the same story and having the reactions they're having. It makes it a more dynamic experience for everyone, all the audience members, and for the performers. I think we're trying to find places in our life, and there are a few of them, where you can be in a room with people who don't look like you, you know? And like, and I think we're always aspiring to try to have our inside look like the outside. Like, how do we create a space where everyone can feel welcome, regardless of what your income status is, or your cultural status, you know, your culture, you know, or your age, you know, all the different ways, the descriptors, the kind of people that you fall in love with. We want all those people to feel like they can see themselves on our stages and in our audiences. It's not just because, sure, plenty of people sell out. There are theaters in this town or in the Bay Area that are sold out every night with people that are between 65 and 80. That's 90% of the audience. And you could do that, and you can use that as a business model. I don't think it's a good business model. People can do that. I just don't think it makes the experience as rich.
The other question I wanted to ask concerns subscriptions. I know that after the pandemic, subscriptions came down 30 to 35 to 40%. And as a model, it's not a workable model. It seems to me that what you're doing is not worrying as much about subscriptions on the grounds that people will come whether they've subscribed or not.
Richard, I worry about everything. I think that's another reason. That's another reason why we're still here. I worry about everything. I want to sell as many single tickets. I want to break my single ticket record every year, and I want to get more subscribers every year. And I am not a person who thinks that the subscription model is on its way out. We did take a huge hit post-pandemic, no doubt about it. But I believe like you want to cultivate a healthy subscriber base because those are the people that are going to be in the trenches for you when things go down. You need those people that see you as their third space. They have their job they go to, they have their home, and this other place where they go to spend time and make community. People used to go to church, or they would do the social clubs, whatever. We want to be that other place that you go with your friends and congregate. And so the other thing is that just on a practical matter, your subscribers are the people that will eventually become your donors and your patrons. They'll be the people that show up at a city council meeting when you have trouble. They're going to be the people that are going to like spread the word about you to other folks. They're buying tickets before Lily Janik has said a word. They're your lifeblood. And so we're back now to getting numbers that we had before the bottom fell out during the pandemic. It's taken us 4 or 5 years to get there, but we're there. And I want us to continue to grow that base. Now, and we've come up with other ways. Like we have flex passes, so you can get like 4 to 6 tickets to use whenever you want to use them. Yeah, yeah. So we've got that. But I want people coming 5 times a year or more. You know, and we have other opportunities that we're offering folks so they can come, you know, every 3 weeks to something here if they want to.
Patrick Dooley, let's talk a little bit about this season. Now, currently we have The Goat or Who is Sylvia by Edward Albee. What prompted you to choose that show? Had that play been on
your radar for a long time?
Yeah, we actually did it. Speaking of the pandemic, we did a reading of this. There's a friend of mine named Jonathan Dio, who runs a wealth investment thing for like his, for a small community here. And he was looking for something for his clients to do during the pandemic. He buys out a night of the theater every year and invites all of his clients to come see a show. Couldn't do that when we're shut down. So he said, what do you say? I host a reading. And I said, I got an idea. And so we did this for his clients. One of his clients is also a supporter of Shotgun. And he loved it so much when the pandemic ended. He said, hey, he every year hosts a play reading in his backyard. We've done Romeo and Juliet. He's got a beautiful bucolic backyard. Romeo and Juliet, Midsummer Night's Dream, Arcadia by Tom Stoppard. And he said, what if you'd bring the goat over? You want to bring this play to your backyard for your neighbors here in the Oakland Hills? You got it, pal. Are you sure? I remember the director went to him and said, what's wrong with you? There's something that goes on in that show. It is that just taps into something sort of elemental humanity that feels an important thing to be touching. And so the play has sort of been sitting in my mind. And I have to tell you, frankly, I don't know why it had such a profound impact on me, which is why I wanted to do it, because I wanted to spend some time for us being in the world of this play. And when I was thinking about what was kind of going on in the world right now, we're in 2026 with all of the insanity that's going on in the news. It's like every article seems like it was written by The Onion, but the tragic Onion. And it's so absurd. For me, this is the kind of terrain that Ionesco was on when he was writing Rhinoceros, that everything is just bizarro world. And so I was looking for plays that was tapping into that absurdity just so that we didn't feel insane for how absurd real life was feeling. Like, how can the theater somehow replicate that heightened absurdity on stage? And there's something about this play, I don't know how much we'll get into it, that where Albie is tapping into the elements of Greek tragedy, even with the title itself, the goat. You know, the word goat in Greek, the word tragedy in Greek is goat song. So like, which is a reference to the sacrifice around the theater festivals. So he's playing with that. And I felt like a time like now, that heightened time like now required plays that trafficked with the Greeks, in the world of the Greeks.
A lot of playwrights, and Albie is one of them, Tennessee Williams is another, even Chekhov, we see the big plays, the famous plays, over and over and over again. And what we miss out are on the plays that are a little bit off base or don't get quite the buzz that the big ones do. And I'm going, I want to see some of them.
100%. What I used to do in the early days when I was plotting out the seasons, the plays we're going to do, what I used to say is I want to do unknown plays by well-known writers. So when we did David Mamet, we did The Frog Prince. We did All Men Are Whores. We did The Shawl. We did Edmund. We did these plays and what I was thinking, like the business, because I realized it's show business. The business part of my brain knew that they don't know who the Shotgun players are at all. And they may not want to go to Laval's, but they've heard of Harold Pinter or they've heard of David Mamet. And so maybe they'll come see, you know, let Berkeley Rep do American Buffalo and Glengarry. We're going to do this other one that they're like curious to come check out, you know, because they may not know our brand, but they'll know that playwright's brand. And that's what we did. And I like to be that theater. Now we'll dabble and we'll do a well-known play by a well-known writer now.
Right. You know, yeah.
We did Sunday in the Park with George, but I am also attracted to that same idea. And we're looking at some plays right now by other playwrights we're looking at Tennessee Williams, and we're looking at some of those plays that you're not going to see in the big houses.
Patrick Dooley, the second play of the season, which starts on May 23rd and continues to June 21st until it extends, Continuity by Bess Wahl, 2019, it's about an echo thriller being shot in the Southwest with all kinds of strange goings on. How did you find it?
You know, we were looking for a play that was dealing with the climate apocalypse that wasn't going to be a downer, That wasn't going to be a play that, like, I mean, that was that dealt with the hard truths of what's going on with the environment. But you didn't walk out there feeling like you just were served a plate of raw broccoli and said, here is a play about the environment to make you feel like you're doing something about the environment, you know? And what I loved is a great section in the play where there's a scientist they brought in to be an expert. And he said, you know, there was a study done about people who go to see movies about the environment actually do less to actually protect the environment than others. That, like, the people think they're checking their environmental box and their psyche by seeing a play. You know, and this is a play that's about the making of a movie about the environment, environmental apocalypse. So there's all these like meta levels going on there. And anyway, this is the best role was the playwright. For those of you who might be paying attention to what's going on in New York theater, has a play called Liberation on Broadway that's getting a lot of buzz right now. She's written another play called Small Mouth Sounds that ran through the regional theater circuit some years ago and did really well. This play didn't take a big run, you know, it had a tricky run in New York, but I think it had more to do with the production. And so we fell in love with it. I think it's very funny. There's a lot of truth in there. There's really wonderful characters they're dealing with a lot of things, a lot of interesting themes. Emily Whalen, who directed Art for us last year, that was so successful, is the director for the show. We've got a lot of great local actors, some familiar faces. And if the people have come to see our plays the last few years, they'll see some people they've seen the last few years kind of popping up in other parts.
You're listening to an interview with Patrick Dooley, who is the artistic director of Shotgun Players. The Goat or Where is Sylvia by Edward Albee plays at the Ashby Stage through May 3rd. And for more information, you could go to shotgunplayers.org. I'm Rich Walensky on the Book Waves, Art Waves Hour. The next show is Iphigenia and Splot, and that takes place in Wales. It's a 2015 play that I was looking it up, trying to find out where it started. It was in Cardiff in Edinburgh and was actually filmed in 2016, a one-woman show, right?
That's right. It's a one-woman show that inspired by the Iphigenia and Aulis Euripides play. We've never done a one-person show before. This is the first, but I read, you know, we did Iphigenia and Aulis back in 2001 at John Hinkle Park, and it was a magical experience. And I'm always a little bit skeptical of some of the more contemporary adaptations of the Greek tragedies, but this one for me just nailed it. Gary Owen, the person who did the adaptation, just did a spectacular job. It pays homage to the original. It is uniquely its own piece of theater, and it is a tour de force opportunity for the actress who's going to be playing this character. It'll be directed by Michelle Targaro, who directed the play 36 by Leah Nanico Winkler that ended our season two seasons ago and could have also still be running right now if we didn't have another show coming in. It was so popular. And we just casted the woman who's going to be carrying this 90 straight minutes by herself. This taps into what I was mentioning earlier of wanting to do plays that have big ideas, because the world that we're in right now, everything feels so overwhelming and huge. We needed something that could meet the moment of what's happening in the world. How did I find it? You know, I was doing some research. I was doing some research on Greek plays. And somehow it came across in one of my search engines, and I started reading about it. And then I had just been in London and seen an adaptation of Ibsen's Ghosts that blew my mind. I was speechless at the end of the production. And I said, and I went and bought the script adaptation by Gary Owen. And I went, wait a minute, this is that guy that wrote that Iphigenia and Splot. Same guy. I had the same just gut-wrenching, but just like it makes it, I wouldn't say it makes it hurt so good, it makes it feel so good. You're in the hands of a spectacular storyteller. I'm thrilled that we're doing it. There was a production of it in New York that was very well reviewed at 59 East 59th Street that had the original actress who's played it. And I think a few other theater companies that traffic in works from the UK have done it.
We have a couple more shows to talk about, but how does it work for you, Patrick Dooley, to find plays, to figure it out? I mean, you've been doing this a long time, so, you know, you have your methods. How does that work for you? How do you find stuff?
That's a great question. You know, what our it's evolved, as you can imagine, over the 30 some years. It's always been a little bit different, but we actually have a structured process for that in the organization now. I've got a committee of 6-7 folks who read plays, and we've got a Google sheet that's got 70 play titles on it that I'm going through at the year and throwing these scripts in there. Liz Lyle, our managing director, goes through and tracks down plays. We'll find, you know, she and I will look for plays in theater companies that we respect. What are other folks producing? You know, I also look to see playwrights that I like or I'm interested in, to kind of see, like, start reading all of their other plays. Like, you know, they may have this one famous play. What else have they written, you know, that may not be getting produced? Kind of speaking to your earlier point about those unknown shows by well-known writers. And we meet every Tuesday. We actually just finished our meeting. We meet from 12 to 1:30. We talk about 3 or 4 of the shows that have been assigned from the week prior. We do this for 5 months, and we just read through these plays. We talk through them all. We debate them, the pros and cons. Every now and again, some folks really love it, but some folks really don't like it, I'll organize some actors to come in, and we'll do a reading of it so we can kind of hear it and then have another discussion. And then, you know, we'll get the plays that are kind of risen to the top, that are still alive at the end of, you know, as we get closer to May and June. And then I'll start trying to look for, are there any themes that are emerging from the ones that we're responding, that we're enjoying? Is there something there? Is there a story that we can tell with these plays? And what order would we put them to, like, have this narrative arc work through the course of the season? So you've got your starter meal, and then your next course, and then your next course, and then your pairing. You're like, how are we assembling a season that is in conversation with itself and complementing itself? And maybe even, you know, because the Bay Area, this is something I talked about earlier, is such an eclectic community, so many different kinds of people with so many different kinds of interests. Are we getting enough different kinds of plays, not just thematically, but also aesthetics? You know, are we playing with music? Are we playing with movement? Are we playing with, like, different ways that we can use the space? Like, what is the dare of this play? Is there a reason why somebody else shouldn't be doing the show? Why do we have to do the show in the way that we like to do theater? That you come into theater every night going, like, I don't know what's going to happen. I may not love it, but something is going to happen. The goat that you saw recently, we're not going to talk about what happens at the end of that play, but I read this play, was talking with the director, Kevin, who had done a reading of it in this backyard that I was talking about. And I said, Kevin, I want you to direct the show for us. And he says, well, I've been thinking about it. And if I were going to do it, this is the only way I can imagine doing it. And he described to me his vision for the show. And then I said, Kevin, you have to do this show now. There's not a conversation about whether you're going to do it or not going to do it. You have to do the show because I have to see that play. What I want, Richard, is I want to be jealous of every director that's working here that I'm not directing that play. I want to love every play so much that I wish I was directing them all. You know, now I'm so glad that I'm not, because it means I get to work with all these great people. You know, in some ways, I really feel like the biggest contribution that I can make is bringing all the people in the room together and then getting them the resources and what they need so they can just run and I can be a supporter and do what originally drew me to theater, which is to be an audience member.
I've noticed in the past, maybe it's since Cal Shakes folded, but your sets are getting really incredible.
Before Cal Shakes folded, but Cal Scenic, who used to be the folks who ran the shop at Cal Shakes, in order to keep their carpenters and their technicians employed when Cal Shakes was not producing, Cal Shakes used to kind of job them out to other theaters to build in the winter and the spring to keep them so they wouldn't have to lay folks off and then rehire them again and see if they were still around. And so that started back then. And I don't know how we first were introduced. If they introduced, they came to us or we saw them, but somewhere along the line, we thought, you know, what would happen if we became one of their clients, or they became one of our clients? I'm not sure how that works. They're so good there because they've got their own shop. They're all professional builders. They cost 3 times what we used to pay, but everything is delivered on time and it never breaks. Or very, if there's an issue, they're there the next day to fix it. It's all fully guaranteed.
It's obvious in seeing the shows. I can see you walk in and we're suddenly in a somewhat different world than the Shotgun of a few years ago.
Yeah.
And of course, you've got Nina Ball there, who is one of the leading Bay Area designers.
And I would say emerging nationally. She's working all around the country now, you know. But yeah, she's just doing, it's hard to believe, but she's just doing her first show at Berkeley Rep after having directed and designed at ACT and OSF and Marin Theater and Cal Shakes for the last 10 years. But she's just opened her first show at Berkeley Rep. Monster.
The fall show is the next show. That's in September 26th to October 25th. That's a world premiere?
Well, I mean, what Erica's doing is she's working with the playwright Chuck Mee. And Chuck Mee, if you're familiar with Charles Mee as a playwright, is a sort of a collage playwright. He's taking snips from magazine articles and poems and other things and writing and kind of fusing all of these different things together in his plays. His plays are all open source. He doesn't charge royalties for any of his plays. And what Erica did, you know, with Charles Mee's approval, was go through his plays and kind of create an assembly of his plays, starting often with the stage directions of some of his plays. And so this is a world premiere, but it's a world premiere using source material from many different shows.
The final show is The Death of Meyerhold by Mark Jackson, coming back around, and that's a 3-hour show.
Long show. 2:45. Yeah, about 2:40, 2:45. Yeah, and this is the first time we've ever done a show twice. When we did do Midsummer one time as a puppet show, and then with actors. So that in some ways we did that show twice, but this is the first time we've ever done a play twice. And of course, Mark has rewritten a lot of the play to kind of bring it up to the, you know, 21st century, or the, you know, where we are in the 21st century to speak to this particular moment. I have been in love with it. It was the last time I was actually in a play. I was in that production. And then my daughter was born a few months later, and I haven't been in a play since I had kids. But I remember just the play is like a love letter to theater and a celebration of theater. And but what also struck me about it, it felt almost quaint to do it at the time, about this Russian theater maker standing up to this authoritarian regime and trying to kind of have his own voice in a world that was trying to shut him down. And I think we thought we were doing something then, and now, but then we look in the world that we're in now, where it's not far, the things that were happening, and I hate to sound hyperbolic, but a lot of the things that were happening in Russia and the beginning of the Stalin regime are very familiar to what's happening in the world right now. And it's just, there's not even, you can't even pretend otherwise. It is exactly what's happening. And I felt like if there ever was a time to do a play about an artist or a movement standing up to an authoritarian regime, it's now. And Mark never likes to go back and do anything twice, but I particularly, and I said, Mark, this is it, man. We have to do the show. And he's like, you're right. And we have got a dynamite cast for the show. You know, it will be The Death of Meyerhold, and it's also a reimagination of that play. And you will be, if you saw the play 20 some years ago, it'll be like seeing it for the first time. I promise you. And we're going to run the hell out of it, Richard. We're going to run the hell out of it.
Yeah, and you can extend that one.
This is the last show of the year. We're going to take it into 2027.
You've been listening to an interview with Patrick Dooley, who is the artistic director of Shotgun Players, which performs at the Ashby Stage near the Ashby BART station. The Goat, or Who Is Sylvia, by Edward Albee, plays through May 3rd. And for more information on that and all the other shows, you can go to shotgunplayers.org. And also, we didn't discuss it, but Patrick is now doing a podcast where he speaks with other theater directors and artistic directors, and you could find that out at shotgunplayers.org. I'm Richard Walensky on the Book Waves Art Waves Hour. Coming up now, the weekly Book Waves Art Waves Theater Review. Putting aside solo performances,
The heart of the theatrical experience usually lies in the interaction between two characters, no matter the size of the cast. Obviously, several characters and plays can interact with each other at once, but the most intense scenes are usually one-on-one. Here's the thing, though. None of it quite works the same way in film or TV. There are multiple takes, cross-cutting. Confrontations might even be recorded separately and put together in post-production. It feels real, but too often it isn't. Only in live theater can we see the meeting happening in front of us. And that's the key to Why the Monsters by Ngozi Anyanwu, now at Berkeley Rep's Pete's Theater through May 3rd, works so well. Big is a fighter in the world of mixed martial arts, which has grown into a major sports competition and combines various disciplines which can, at times, seem almost balletic. Lil, whose real name is Josephine, shows up after one of his bouts, and after some back and forth, reveals she's the younger half-sister he abandoned in his late teens to go out in the world and find himself. It's awkward. They'd been close when she was at the start of her middle childhood, and then he was gone. Gradually, we'll now feel the pull of family, as will she, but it will take time and effort on both their parts. This is a play about siblings, about the restrictions inherent upon Black people growing up in mixed and broken families, with the physicality of the competition serving as metaphor for their growing relationship, as attitudes and situations shift between the two. The playwright herself, Ngozi Anyanwu, plays Lil, spunky, irreverent, and Sullivan Jones more than matches her as Big in both his physicality and his emotional truthfulness. Their interplay, their moments of quiet, of fun, of anger, and of confrontation can only reach its apex in live theater. The playwright notes that, quote, there are big political things happening in the world. I think the way to engage politically is by humanizing people, and that starts at home. I'm always trying to make sure people feel seen. In Monster, both through the play's script, through the direction of Tamila Woodward, and through the often raw and honest acting, these characters and their need for connection is clearly and satisfyingly seen. The Monsters by Ngozi Anyanwu plays at Berkeley Rep's Pete's Theater through May 3rd. For more information, you can go to berkeleyrep.org. Until next week, I'm Richard Walensky on the Bookwaves Arthwaves Hour.
John Nichols of The Nation on why KPFA matters now more than ever.
There's no better place to invest your extra cash or resources than this station, because this deeper level of discussion about war and peace is not heard everywhere. And the quality of these discussions on this station merits support. It merits contributions that make sure that this station is able to not just do what it does now, but to expand its coverage of these critical issues. At a point when much of the media will fail, this station does not fail. So please give.
Support independent media that doesn't back down. Donate today at kpfa.org.
KPFA.
For 75 years, KPFA has presented progressive voices who spoke truth to power. Odetta.
Odetta, you were one of the first women I ever saw wearing an afro.
I first saw it on a dancer by the name of Ginny Lagone in Los Angeles. And when she did programs of African lore, she would have her hair in natural. And I remember running into her at City College in Los Angeles. And she was getting ready to do a program, and she had that natural. I said, hey, Ginny, and I was talking to her, but I couldn't keep my eyes away from her hair.
94.1 FM, 75 years of building community trust. Support us today at kpfa.org.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.